Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, and my guest is the Honourable Barbara Jones, Consul General of Ireland in New York, and I want to welcome you, Barbara.
Thanks very much, Adrian. It's great to be here.
Hailing from Wexford, but you've had I was going to say checkered, but it's not a checkered. It was a very exciting career over the last 30 years plus in foreign affairs and in the department.
Yeah, I would certainly feel very, very honoured and very fortunate in my career. First of all, on the important issues that have faced Ireland in that time, and having had a chance to be in some way part of how we responded to some of the challenges we've had. And second of all, I feel very proud to be a Wexford woman. I mean, I'm from Enniscorthy, the town of Enniscorthy, and one of the really sweet things about being Consul General of Ireland in New York has been the warm friendship that the Wexford Association have given to me, and they're a great team of men and women there, invigorating and keeping, giving a new direction to the association. We had Art Foley. We had a big event for Art Foley, the great Wexford sportsman, a couple of months ago. So, yeah, I mean, I think it is that Seamus Heaney, in one of his great essays about Wordsworth, spoke about the importance of place in Wordsworth's poetry, and he reflected in it something along the lines of, how can somebody know who they are if they don't know where they're from? And I very much feel very fortunate in having had a great upbringing, great education with the Presentation Sisters and Mercy Sisters, and a wonderful family and a great community, which everybody, of course, has seen now, Adrian, some glimpse of it in this movie, Brooklyn, that Colm Tobin, a great, great, great writer, and, of course, from a great Enniscorthy family, almost a dynasty. His sister Barbara taught me Irish, and his sister Nuala taught my younger brother Tomás in primary school. So I feel very blessed to be in New York, just as Colm is such a celebrity for
Absolutely.
The town.
Yes. Let me ask you about your career prior to this assignment. Very involved in Anglo-Irish and in European Union issues. How do we separate those? Because we know then you became deputy head of mission at the Embassy of Ireland in London, dealing primarily with relations to Northern Ireland peace process. Just take us to the in chronological order, to that first assignment.
Okay. Well, I mean, the first thing to say, and you'll know this from having had so many of my distinguished predecessors here, having had the opportunity to interview them, and you will know and recall that the Irish Foreign Ministry is a small foreign ministry, and diplomats or civil servants who work in the Department of Foreign Affairs are expected to turn their hand to whatever the assignment they're offered. So unlike other foreign ministries, we don't really have specialists. For example, in the American Foreign Service, you could become an expert on Middle Eastern policy and devote your entire career to assignments and analysis to do with the Middle East. That's not the case in Ireland. So I suppose what the thread in my career is, because I'm a working mum, has been an attempt to give priority to my family. I have three children, and at a certain point of my career, I was very keen to remain in Ireland. So I have an atypical diplomatic career in that I worked in the Taoiseach's department as a speechwriter, and I work in the Department of Enterprise, Trade and Employment as a desk-based, HQ-based official, which is very important because it gave my sons, who were going to Gonzaga College in Dublin, the opportunity to have continuity in their education. So that's a big thread for me, the sort of over and back of making sure that there is a balance that is tilted always, not towards my career, but rather towards my responsibility and my husband's responsibility towards our kids and their education. And then what happened was, for me, was that very early on in my career when I joined the department, Gareth Fitzgerald and Peter Barry were negotiating the Anglo-Irish Agreement. And that really was the breakthrough moment for British-Irish relations, because it was the first time since the original treaty after the War of Independence that we had sat down with the British government at such a senior level and in such a considered way to try and find a new way of managing British-Irish relations. And I suppose, Adrian, what happened was, because I worked with a team of people like Michael Illis, Sean Donlan, great, the best diplomats you could imagine, you got the
most
sort of
them having done a stint here.
Here, exactly. But what was amazing about it for me was the insight that one gets from being close to great people. And these were great public officials. And Gareth Fitzgerald was a great leader and somebody I admired. So getting, being close to, my role at that stage was often, you know, opening the door when John Hume and Seamus Mallon and Joe Hendren would come down for, you know, debriefing talks with Peter Barry. But you were sitting in on some of those meetings and you were taking the note. So you were actually getting the opportunity to understand actually how high-level negotiations happen. And I suppose what it really brought home to me was that for the future of Ireland and for the future reconciliation in Ireland, we had to fix our resolve the difficulty we had with the British, who were very critical at that time, as you know, of our security posture. So it was a very, very important agreement, the Anglo-Irish Agreement, and I suppose I got the love of British-Irish relations at that moment and an understanding of the role of the Department of Foreign Affairs, with the Taoiseach's Department, of course, to bring all that forward. And that stayed with me. So any time I could tilt my career back in that direction, I've tried to do so, and I've had great support from the department in helping me do that.
Would it be fair to categorise the Anglo-Irish Agreement as the precursor to what would be the focal point, the Good Friday Agreement, the Belfast Agreement?
I think that's fair. I mean, I think what it does is it puts a framework around dialogue between the two governments by establishing a secretariat, which was affectionately called the Bunker in Maryfield in Belfast. And it gave a permanency to the conversation and to the idea that the best diplomatic conversations are not when you're taking up a loudhailer and talking at one another, but when you're finding tables and chairs and sitting down and talking to and with and listening to each other. So that was the first thing. And that permanent structure, you know, has survived into actually my last job, effectively, was that. And then the second thing was this extraordinary acknowledgement that we gave, a very important acknowledgement that we gave, that the resolution of the problem of Northern Ireland was subject to the principle of consent, the consent of the majority of people, i.e. Protestant Unionist people, Loyalist people in Northern Ireland. It was in their hands whether there would be unity in Ireland. And that was a very important, to get the principle of consent so much ingrained into the relationship. And then the third thing, I suppose, about that was this magical expression, which definitely has stayed with me all my life, that in our dealings with the British government, quote, determined efforts would be made to resolve differences, end quote. And what that
as
meant,
opposed to conflict resolution, it basically is there's a distinction there in terms of you're both trying to get onto a common path.
Exactly, and it's magical, because what it means is both sides by acknowledging, this is a language from an international treaty that was lodged at the UN, both sides are saying, it's not sufficient for me, let's say, as Irish government, to state what I disagree with. vis-a-vis British policy, let's say, at that time. But what I have to do is to put myself almost into the boots of the British team and imagine what the solution might look like. So we are both going to make determined efforts to resolve differences. And I find that that's magical. That really is a magical thing. You can't just sit there pointing fingers. You really have to engage in an exchange.
Yeah. Okay. That, of course, brings us to the reality of dealing with the past, which, in fact, many would feel has been poorly handled. It's ongoing, thus we should not expect too much to come from that. But as we're heading into the centenary of the 1916 rising in Ireland, which is being commemorated and celebrated this year throughout the world, is the area of the past, is that acceptable in pretty much the same way many of the negotiations which have taken place in involving the North, is that something that we're hoping would go away, that we acknowledge the right of those who have really had the experience and indeed were part of a very tough period, we on one hand don't want that to interfere with the peace process in Northern Ireland and the future of the island of Ireland and our relationship with Britain. And on the other hand, you can't leave it hanging out there as an old sore and expect that those who were, brutally affected by that period, that, you know, they should get over it.
Yeah. Well, I think that even, if I may say, your question is so eloquent because you have captured the complexity of even talking about this. One instantly is driven into a form of discourse or use of language where you're qualifying everything because everything needs to be qualified. It is such a complex issue. So that's the first thing I want to say, and I really would wish that anything that I say around this be tried to be drawn together in some sort of a holistic way. Dealing with the past was not possible. The issue of dealing with the past was not a feature of the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. There were arrangements made as part of the settlement for the release of prisoners, Loyalist prisoners, and IRA prisoners, and a very good structure, and international people helped us review those cases, and people were not given amnesty, neither were they given freedom. They were given conditional freedom. They were given release on a license from the Secretary of State, and in the South different arrangements were made. But the more comprehensive issue of legacy and all of the unsolved murders was not a feature of the Good Friday Agreement. And I think great credit should be given to Sir Hugh Orde, who was then the head of the PSNI, in attempts that he made earlier on in his time to give accounts to many, many of the victims' families who were saying, where is the investigation into my father's murder, my brother's murder?
Yeah.
So he did, he in his own way. And various attempts, the most important, have been made since then. The most important attempt, in my view and in the view of the Irish government, has been a report which was done by Lord Eames, the Anglican Church of Ireland bishop, and at the request of the British government. And we had the Eames Bradley, Dennis Bradley from Derry, a great civil rights person, a great writer, a great commentator, and a person who was instrumental in peace coming into Ireland. And they did a report which sort of, I suppose, surveyed the whole landscape of the issues that you're talking about. Right. And that's a central report. And it is disappointing that despite the fact that that report has been with us now for so long, we actually haven't found the framework. Richard Haass and Megan O'Sullivan made a very good reflection on the issues involved in dealing with the past. And in the Stormont House agreement, there were very, very good discussions as well, but no agreement was reached ultimately between Sinn Féin and the British government on it. So basically, by way of saying, people of good faith on all sides are trying, and I think with good purpose and good intent, to find a pathway through this, which balances, I suppose, justice and accountability with the opportunity of reconciliation. I remain hopeful. It's the number one issue, because certainly there, you talked about sores and hurt and trauma. All of that is true. And people, hundreds and hundreds of families in Northern Ireland, have no idea what happened to their loved ones. And I think at a minimum, we should now with urgency make sure that people can get an account of what happened, with a view not to forgetting, but actually to help people recover and grieve with some decency.
Might be good to point out at this time that we are not talking about politics or religion, because in this case, because a death, a destruction, a war that hits a family, the least important part of that is what their political affiliation, what their religious affiliation was. And I think sometimes we probably, lean towards thinking, that perhaps this is our side to tuck the beating. On that alone, it would be helpful, I think, if we look at, the ravages of war, or whatever you want to call it, it is still to the families who have been affected.
Yes.
This is something, that is real, and perhaps in the interest of going forward, we are not just talking about, again, a small segment of a community, but rather, the overall conflict, that period in Northern Ireland, which changed.
I think it's a very fair observation. I mean, the idea that the impact and the hurt and the loss is a universal experience. I mean, the grief that one encounters meeting a Catholic or a Protestant with a woman who's lost her husband or her son when he was with the RUC, or mm-hmm. British soldier, an IRA person, it's the same grief. It's a universal grief. But I suppose, as a public official, being fortunate enough to be a civil servant, you have to imagine that government policy and law can help in this and help societies recover. Now, government and law can't do everything, because obviously churches and these are fundamentally moral things as well. But there is a role, and I'm glad to say that I do feel that in the last round of talks we've made more progress in finding a framework which would bring accountability and justice into the equation, as opposed to amnesia, because the part of the problem in Ireland is that most people feel they know what happened, but it's the lack of acknowledgement, it's the silence around that in itself is very, very damaging. And ultimately, because there will be reconciliation in Ireland, because we're all going to continue to work for that, this has to be seen as something that may delay and could potentially, if the legacy issues are not dealt with well, provide a basis for people to continue to justify the use of political violence in Ireland. And the British government have their responsibility in that regard as well.
Yes. Now, on this year, in 2016, there are a couple of major events that we should look at, and in fact, they have a tie. We're talking St. Patrick's Day, and we're talking about a Grand Marshal who, in fact, played such an amazing role in Northern Ireland, and Senator George Mitchell accepting this honour with basic provisions which have come to which have become a reality this year. Inclusion, the key word being inclusion for you know, a segment of our community that has for 25 years been pretty much you know, kept out by virtue of, you know, their own leanings, which to many were simply not acceptable in what was perceived as a Catholic parade. A lot of effort, a lot of energy had gone into that, and many would say it shouldn't have taken 25 years. We also have to acknowledge that the inclusion this year is going to, for some people, be very difficult to accept, primarily on religious reasons or you know, the an attitude that has persisted. So how do we accept the fact that change is hard to take? How do we accept the fact that you know, the right thing has been done, however, there are many who feel that they have lost ground without bearing any of the responsibility for what might have been, you know, easily sorted out in the past. There was almost, it almost had to come to a collision course, and with the outside forces, including, you know, the Cardinal Dolan last year. But there are going to be a lot of people who are going to say, you know, oh, finally we collectively had to give in. What do you say to those people?
Well, I think that when you say that change is very difficult, and particularly on issues that people hold very dear to them, I think you're absolutely right. Change is very difficult. And that's why leadership is so important. And therefore, I think around the issue of the complex issues to do with parading, I think the leadership which the Pope himself has given on the issue of sexual identity, Cardinal Dolan's leadership in marching as Grand Marshal, and as a brilliant Grand Marshal last year, provided a pathway for people which maybe wasn't available before. And that's where I think in the public leadership within the church space, because as you say, it is a Catholic parade and it is in honour of the patron saint of Ireland for the cathedral, which many Roman Catholics, and indeed as a practicing Roman Catholic myself, I love the cathedral. So it bears the name and is deeply rooted in our sense of who we are as Roman Catholics, as Catholics. And then the leadership around inclusion, or I suppose from my Northern Ireland and from the Irish government position, the whole question of respect and reconciliation. They're very fundamental principles in Irish political thinking about change. So the respect that is sought is offered in a spirit of reconciliation. And I think the people in the community who have brought around, who have created an opportunity for these conversations, going back to Cardinal Dolan's own important role last year, I think really, really deserve great credit. And I hope that people can respect the traditions that people hold dear, because it isn't, the art of this, I think, is that people must be allowed to feel that nobody has lost. This wasn't a battle. This was what this has become has been a conversation about broadening out our understanding of what it is to be Irish.
And in addition to it being truly acknowledged as a Catholic parade, it is our Irish parade. largest in the world, and, you know, should incorporate not just the Catholic line, but equally so the fact that this is Ireland, it's Irish, it is St. Patrick's, it's all of that. But in fact, St. Patrick's Day, St. Patrick's Day Parade in New York City, is for everybody. And it has, it has that image, and this is what we project throughout the world. So whereas we seem to be, for all the years that I have been here, we seem to come up with something of a controversial nature each and every year, there is now a great opportunity to go forward, particularly this year,
yes,
2016. This is the centenary of big change, the kind of changes that we were talking about, you know, existed 100 years ago, and that also was major. That was something that changed lives forever.
Yes.
So,
I mean, I think that 2016 does provide a great framework for all of us to reflect on change and historical change. And one of the, I think, really, really important things about the 1916 centennial is the positioning and the importance of the proclamation of the Irish Republic as a statement of the fundamental values, the bunrocks, that the very fundamental values that that republic, that revolutionary generation, envisaged as being the determining values of Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, they're all there. I mean, in relation to reconciliation in Ireland, for example, the proclamation is read by Pearse under the tricolour, green, white and orange. He's talking about an Irish Republic where he's looking forward to reconciliation between orange and green. There are parts of the proclamation which are revolutionary in acknowledging the importance of the famine generation and their descendants in the United States of America.
Absolutely,
specifically,
yeah.
Talking about thanking. I mean, in a proclamation of our republic, they took time to thank Ireland's exiled children in America. I mean, which I think one really does have to reflect on that, because it demonstrates how much that generation understood that freedom in Ireland was only possible because of that support, and the achievement of freedom and reconciliation in Ireland would not happen without her exiled children in America getting engaged. And then I suppose a lot of people who are very concerned about the role of women in Irish society seize upon the very important emphasis that Connolly, in working on this draft, put on the role of women, because yes, it's the first international such document that refers and addresses itself, or the Republic is addressing itself to Irish men and Irish women. And at that time, of course, as we all know, women didn't have the vote. But the Republic is saying, Irish men and Irish women, I'm claiming your allegiance, and they're pointing to the elections. Explicitly, mm-hmm. therefore, saying that women in the Irish Republic were going to be given the vote, and then there are other parts which talk about the Irish Republic cherishing all the children of the nation equally and being oblivious to the differences in Northern Ireland, on the island between orange and green, and looking forward to reconciliation. I mean, it's an amazing document, and I love the way this year, Adrian, through the work in our community here in Irish America, particularly in the states I'm responsible for, that at every moment you turn and look at the schedule, there's some contribution being offered or being made by scholars to greater understanding of the role of Irish America in all of that. I'm delighted that the Speaker Viverito and the council members in the Irish American Caucus have been invited by the Irish government to be in Dublin to mark the Easter Rising, and I am so honoured to be in a position to be accompanying them on that trip. And then when we come back from the Easter Rising events in Dublin at the end of March, we will be full steam into preparing for a major series of events in the week of the 18th, 19th of April, a big symposium in Glucksman Ireland House, and a major new exhibition up at the American Irish Historical Society. And then on the Saturday and Sunday, major events, one by the Hibernians in New York, which we will host here at the Consulate, with a beautiful mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral. And then on the Sunday, civic event down in Battery Park City Authority, who have been extraordinarily generous to us in giving us facilities down there. And Danny MacDonald is giving us the facilities at Pier A for a cultural programme in that afternoon, which is titled Welcoming Ireland.
Yes. Now, we are the focal day. And I think we should acknowledge the date, because we are celebrating and commemorating 1916, probably as much here, if not more so, than in Ireland itself. We are taking the whole year.
Yes.
But the focal date of April 24th is a common day. This is the day where the commemoration and the celebration will be taking in Ireland, here, and for that matter, many places throughout the world.
It is a fact, Adrian, that on 24th of April here at noontime, we will assemble at Battery Park City Authority at Wagner Park, and we will set up there an outside stage, representatives of the Defence Forces of Ireland will read the proclamation. We'll have VIPs from Ireland. We will have VIPs from the state here. And we will honour the men and women. There's a very solemn protocol for that event, lowering of the flags, playing of the last post. It's solemn. And we will remember and honour the dead, the men and women who gave their lives for Irish freedom 100 years ago. And then, having had the solemn 1916 phase of the programme, we then will pause, and followed by a more cultural, a more celebratory event, which will focus on the relationship between Ireland and New York. And the theme of that festival is Welcoming Ireland. And that festival will be housed on outdoor stages. We'll have some large tents, as I say, Pier A. We will have ticketed events at Pier A that people can attend. And I will give you full details of the programme in another interview when it is finalised, with pointers to help people. But the really important message is everybody is welcome to the event at noontime on the 24th of April 2016, because that's the actual date and the moment at which the turning point where Páraic Pearse reads the proclamation in Dublin. And we're going to capture the time and the moment with the solemn state protocol in Wagner Park, 24 April.
How lucky are we? You mentioned Danny MacDonald, who indeed is the owner-operator of that Pier A. We could not, without the benefit of that particular ownership of that particular spot, that could not happen by happenstance. I have to assume that we had some outside influences, preferably from, I'd like to believe they were from above, that gives us not only again the commemoration at the exact time and whatever, but we're talking about, this is where the Irish actually touched America, and particularly in New York.
Yeah, no, first of all, on just the modalities of this, there is an organising committee here, and the community asked me to lead. You'll recall you were at the meeting about 8 months ago. Would I lead in organising this event on behalf of the community? So we have a brilliant organising committee, and at the heart of the organising committee is a lot of expertise, but also an immense amount of goodwill towards the very relationship between New York and Ireland that we want to highlight on the day. So people are spontaneously, I mean, Danny in his case, he spontaneously offered the use of his facilities. Other people are it's a very expensive event to put together.
Yes.
Spontaneously people are coming and making personal donations and gifts to us. In kind, some of the musicians who will be on the program are some of the finest musicians in Irish America. Mm-hmm. And for very, very modest stipends,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to their usual professional fees, will provide cultural backdrop for the day. So at every level, Adrian, this has been a magical journey of goodwill to create a program on the 24th of April. And in the same way that I feel there has been a great degree of blessing and grace about how the community has come together around St. Patrick's Day itself this year and the programme of events.
Right. We will, as you say, we will, as a matter of fact, from this programme onward, we are going to concentrate on letting everybody know what's happening and when. The one area that I would like to double back to is we did not expect, and definitely I did not expect, that the government of Ireland would be able to put commemoration and celebration in the same sentence. Mm. If we are talking about the centenary of, you know, what was the beginning of another new Irish history. Celebration, commemoration, both. We have, to sell that as a concept. I believe it's great. Had the Irish government just said commemoration, without celebration, just commemoration itself, it would not imply, or it would not give the implication that this, in fact, that we have a lot to celebrate as well as commemorate.
Well, I think that when it's very important to get the tone right. In it's such a momentous moment for Irish history and for the relatives of these men and women who died, and many, many, many families were affected by the subsequent. And we all know we end up in the War of Independence very quickly. We end up in a brutal civil war in a couple of years later. So we know that this moment is a turning point in Irish history. And we know that it's a joyous moment because of the values it proclaims, and that there is great sadness in the way that the British security policy response to the events alienated the people from the opportunity. It's so clear that the British security response, rather, was so inhumane that people changed their mind about the revolution at that moment. So solemnity and memory and honouring is so important in the tone. And then, because we also think of 100 years of nation, of 100 years of statehood, and we're such an ancient nation, we can also feel that the future is bright, because this is a turning point. And if you think of the progress we've made, and we have made progress in 100 years, there are all sorts of reasons on such a day to look to the future with great optimism. So it's in that sort of tone of optimism that I like the idea that here in New York there's a consensus that we should, in the course of that day, really sort of, one person said, we should thank New York, the Irish should thank New York for what New York has done for us. And then, of course, it's exactly then, as you say, by hosting these events in such a part of New York which is resonant with the very footfall of Irish people landing off the boats in from Ellis Island, I think you capture the sense of the continuity of time and the great optimism of the relationship that, you know, Ireland's exiled children in America continue to be our closest friends in the journey towards peace and prosperity and reconciliation in Ireland, and I've no doubt in my mind about that at all.
You know, St. Patrick's Day upon us, and almost on the heels of that, a centenary a very significant one of a newborn Ireland, as I say. We will commit ourselves between now, you know, and the event, not only the singular event, but as we have been doing, there are a lot of commemorations and celebrations during 1916. We will address that. As the government, Irish government, representative in the United States, I know that you bring goodwill and greetings from Ireland, and that despite the period going through, which actually is not brand new to Ireland, which you won't get into, but you're going to bring us a message of goodwill from Ireland, and again of sharing what Ireland definitely has contributed to, the shining light of St. Patrick's Day parades throughout the world, has been and continues to be acknowledged by the government of Ireland, by the people of Ireland. I leave you to it.
Well, the first thing is, I mean, St. Patrick's Day is, I love St. Patrick. I love his writings. He has two significant writings. That's all we have of him. A lot of the rest of it is stories that were built up around his importance. And both of those documents seem to me both, they still speak to the challenges of our time. The first of his confession, reminding us about all of those hugely important values of gracious belief and care for our fellow man, and a sense of time and a sense of culture, and the importance of religion in the public life of everybody. And then an amazing letter which he wrote to a Roman governor complaining at the murder of Christians. And as a bishop, he's writing to condemn the murder of Christians. And I think that these are the things of St. Patrick that are, when you think of the challenge of relations between the place of religion, the role of Christianity in our heritage in Ireland, and to think that in his day he understood fully the risks of and the temptation that there would be for powers to destroy the space for faith in our lives. So I think that St. Patrick is an amazing inspiration to the Irish nation and the challenges that we face in Northern Ireland. Because he is beloved in the Anglican Church of Ireland faith as well, he is a very reconciling figure. St. Patrick's Day is a public holiday in Northern Ireland, as it is in Ireland as a whole. And so I find at every level St. Patrick as an inspiration figure. For me, he is the stranger who came to Ireland, who had a terrible experience as a slave there, and yet he had a calling from God to come back and bring back the Christian faith. And he did that, and he forgave the Irish. And I find the idea of the reconciliation he showed to the Irish nation and in giving his whole life to serve them is inspirational. At the level of the heritage that's wrapped up around St. Patrick's Day here in the United States, it is humbling as a public official to see the hard work, the effort, the love that people have for Ireland at this time, and how they give it expression through dinners, through gatherings, through heritage events. And it is inspiring, because St. Patrick's Day is the reenactment every single year of the love that there is between Irish America and Ireland. And it is moving, and it's an emotional thing. And it is great that in 2016, all of the movement here in New York is around coming together and in honor of our patron saint together.
We will leave it at that, but I think you could be forgiven if you would join us in the pride that we have that St. Patrick, St. Patrick's Day, St. Patrick's Day Parade in New York is a cut above the rest.
Obviously.
Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.